Dip, 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 dip. Sha-la-la-la, sha-la-la-la, puddle. Sha-la-la-la, sha-la-la-la, puddle. Sha-la-la-la, sha-la-la-la, puddle.
Good evening. This is the Labor Exchange. I'm Dennis Kreese, a member of the Boulder Area Labor Council, AFL-CIO. The subject of tonight's program is Social, Labor, and Political Issues, a Progressive Perspective. And with us, as always, is a special guest, Ron Forthover, retired professor, statistics, and community activist. Ron, as I just alluded there to, it's always a privilege to have you here on the Labor Exchange.
Thanks, Dennis. It's a real pleasure to be here with you.
Ron, let's begin with social issues. And so let's begin with a discussion of your guest commentary, quote-unquote, what homelessness says about us. And that's from the Daily Camera, Sunday, December 3rd, 2018. So how does the homeless issue impact workers and their families and on an ongoing basis? And what are some progressive solutions to this issue?
Okay. Well, just as a little background, we've bought into an economic system that tells us if we cannot provide for ourselves and our families, it's not the system's fault, but it's because we are failures. The Western European countries, particularly the Scandinavian nations, have economic systems in which capitalism is more tightly regulated and people have rights to food, shelter, healthcare, things that we lack. Our low-wage jobs don't allow workers to save. Therefore, they can't afford to lose their jobs as they could fairly quickly become homeless. Living wage jobs are a must, but that idea is in conflict with the maximization of profit, a motive that is central in our approach to the economy. This profit motive eliminates space for concepts such as fairness, justice, and compassion, concepts that are central to most religions.
And with that, that's a good segue. How has the control of money overtaken the teachings of most religions, including Christianity? And I got that from your commentary.
Well, I think that we don't want to be viewed as failures. The maximization of profit has been so ingrained in our minds. And under the Reagan administration, greed was no longer a vice, but transformed into a virtue. So religions, they seem to play a less important role in the lives of many people today. And even if you are religious, though, because we live in a very competitive instead of a cooperative society, you can't afford to be compassionate. So I think, you know, just that whole milieu in which we operate tends to downplay fairness, tends to downplay justice, tends to downplay compassion. And we need to change this system because we cannot just go on in this dog-eat-dog world where we look out for number one and we ignore the interest of our fellow human beings.
Ron, let's move on to housing, also known as the popular term anymore, affordable housing. Could you talk about the criticality of this issue for all workers and their families? And again, what might be some immediate solutions, albeit innovative and progressive, to address this issue for the homeless, workers in the lower socioeconomic category, and many others as well?
Well, I think as long as we restrict ourselves to the attention of one issue, we lose sight of the idea that our budget, the nation's federal budget, talks about priorities. And if you look at our budget, where we spend over 60% for the military of the discretionary budget, we are downplaying the role of human rights and of individual rights as well. So when we have a situation in which workers cannot necessarily afford to have a house or a decent apartment, they're stuck in this low-wage job because they fear that if they miss any payments, they're out on their rear end. So we need to try and change this whole system from emphasis on military and the domination of a banking corporate power empire into something where we are following more of the European model, the Scandinavian model, where we prioritize human rights and things that we don't consider rights in this country, idea of shelter, idea of food, idea of health care, education. These things are rights in other countries, but not so much in this country.
All right, then, and you just said something. It's the next question. Health care. How does the lack of health care greatly impact all workers and their families and all those in the lower socioeconomic sector of this U.S. society? And again, what are some progressive solutions for this ongoing health care issue?
Well, I think workers, again, if they are fortunate enough to have a good union job, they are likely to have health care benefits. So they are somewhat better off than the non-unionized workforce who are at the mercy of the corporate powers to say whether you're going to get health care or not. And if you don't have health care in today's money-driven, profit-driven health care system, you probably will wind up in the emergency room, which is the most expensive treatment for any kind of health care condition, just costing the system more and more. In terms of a solution, I think the single-payer approach to financing of health care, where the government doesn't provide the health care, but it provides the resources through public taxation to finance the health care system. So the medical community, the hospital communities are still in charge of the health care that's provided, but the funding, the financing aspect and the paying for it aspect are taken out of the hands of the private sector, thus removing the profit motive to a large extent. The profit motive, again, is the thing that just is so harmful to our system.
And I'm thinking of also universal health care. It might be the same thing, but also I like to, you know, think that another option could be Medicare for all.
Yeah, Medicare for all, I think, in many people's minds, is the same concept as what single-payer is. Single-payer provides for universal health care, and not health care limited to the exclusion of mental health care, dental health care, vision care, things like that, and also would deal with home health services, things that are typically not covered by the health care policies in many situations today. So Medicare for all and single payer, I think, in many people's minds are synonymous.
Let's finish up this section before we move on to labor issues. And I just, last question, how does U.S. capitalism, through private sector insurance companies, interfere with this progressive solution process?
Well, I think the money, again, aspect is the driving force, and the health insurance industry, the pharmaceutical industry, and the large hospitals have played a particularly harmful role in terms of providing funding to politicians to ensure that we don't have a universal public health care system in which, again, the profit motive is greatly downplayed. Studies galore have shown that if you have a nationalized system, a single-payer type system, or even a multi-payer type system where everybody is covered, nobody is excluded from the health care, you can save enormous amounts of money because you have a true economy of scale working, because you have everybody in the system, and so that some small number of catastrophic cases do not bankrupt the system. So you're able to do things at a much more affordable way than the current approaches.
Ron, let's move on to labor issues. And as before, unemployment and underemployment. And this is for December 2018, or maybe it was, I correct myself, it's November 2018. The statistics came out Friday. The United States is still at 3.7% unemployment. Very good number. Colorado, I believe, is still at 2.4%. And Boulder County seems like it fluctuates at an even better range at 1.8 to 2.4%. These figures continue to improve since our last interview, August 21st, 2017. Yet, these two issues continue to prevent many workers from making real progress in present-day U.S. society. As a former professor of statistics, why are these percentages somewhat of a mirage?
Well, you're well aware, there are six different measures that address the issue of unemployment. And unemployment...
And when you say six measures, that's from the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics.
Correct. Yeah. And if you are somebody who works 1 hour a week, you're not considered unemployed if you're being paid a wage or salary. If you've given up looking for a job because there are none available in your field, you're not counted. You're no longer in the labor force. If you're working three jobs, as an example, that doesn't, really deal with, you're employed, but boy, are you employed, and you have no time for your family. You have no time for anything that's important to you. So I think that as long as we are not having living wage jobs, the unemployment situation really doesn't tell the whole story. As you say, these numbers, 3.7% unemployed at the national level, is very impressive. It's very good compared to many other countries. If you look at a different measure where people who have given up looking and things are included, then you're up to like 7.5% or so unemployed. But I think another important issue along with the unemployment is the concept of a living wage. When you're paying a person a minimum wage, typically they cannot afford any quality of life, any decent type of housing at all. You have to work two or three full-time minimum wage jobs to be able to afford something. And there are lots of statistics out there just showing how bad this is.
We're going to get to that here soon, within a couple minutes. So for those of you who have joined us late, this has been the Labor Exchange, and I'm Dennis Kreese, a member of the Boulder Area Labor Council, AFL-CIO, and subject of tonight's program is Social Labor and Political Issues, a Progressive Perspective. And with us is a special guest, Ron Forthover, retired professor, statistics, and a community activist. Ron, let's, in line with all this on labor issues, before we get back to the, livable wage, minimum wage standards, income inequality. As per our last interview, August 21st, 2017, this issue becomes more egregious, albeit widening, every day. Again, as a former professor of statistics, could you update this KGNU listening audience, especially our new and younger listening members, with the amount of monetary assets the 1% has, the 1/100% has, and even 200 to 300 families have here in the United States?
Well, if you look at the richest 400 families in the Forbes 400, that gives us a good idea. Just some examples. In 1982, the poorest American listed on the first annual Forbes magazine list of America's richest 400 had a net worth of only $80 million. The poor person. The average member of that first list had a net worth of $230 million. In 2016, the rich Americans needed a net worth of at least $1.7 billion to enter the Forbes 400.
God.
And the average member held a net worth of $6 billion, over 10 times the 1982 average after adjusting for inflation. These billionaires who make up this 400 list now have as much wealth as all African-American households, plus one-third of the America's Latino population combined. In other words, 400 extremely wealthy individuals have as much wealth as 16 million African-American households and 5 million Latino households in 2015.
That's absolutely incredible.
The top 1/100th of 1% of the wealthy own over 10% of the nation's wealth. This is in 2012. The top 0.1% had over 20% of the wealth, and the top 1% had over 40% of the wealth in this country in 2012. And it's much likely worse today.
Thanks for sharing that. You're always very good with that, and I think the listening audience needs to know that information. Would a progressive tax formula, minus the quote-unquote loopholes, be a step forward to correct this inequality, and what might be some progressive actions to correct all this?
Yeah, I think definitely a progressive income tax system such that was in place under Eisenhower, for example, when the top rate was above 90%, the top marginal rate. I want to emphasize the idea of the marginal. A marginal tax rate of over 90% only applies to money that some truly wealthy person has above some threshold. The threshold may be as high as $10 million or 15 or 20 or 50, whatever. And for the first, say, $30,000, they're paying exactly the same tax rate as anybody who made $30,000. So they're not paying 90-some percent on their whole income. They're paying it just on that above certain thresholds. And you can have steps along the way. So that's an important thing. And I think we were very successful as a nation under Eisenhower economically. So the 90-some percent marginal tax rate did not provide a disincentive to people to continue working long hours to make this extra money. So I think this is something that could be very effective. I think also that we really have to go back to the estate tax and strengthen the estate tax, because this was a way to try and prevent America from becoming an aristocracy where inherited wealth was the thing that provided for people. So if we could, again, implement a strong estate tax that only applies to like 1.5% of the population, this would do a great job in terms of breaking up this inherited wealth in these aristocracies. Another thing that could be done is right now stock transactions are not taxed. So why not? I mean, anything you buy in the store or whatever, you pay an income, you pay a sales tax on. So let's have a small fee on currency transactions, currency speculation, stock trades, things like this, because that would prevent this wild speculation that goes on.
All right, then, Ron, let's move on to like what we were talking about a little bit earlier, and I apologize. I wanted to just delay it a little bit. But minimum wage standards. Today, in the United States, it's $7.25 an hour. In Colorado, it's $10.25. At the start in January, I believe it goes up to $11.20, and then it'll be $12 by 2020. What needs to be done to convince elected officials on the federal, state, and local levels that these rates are not livable wages? And what would be a fair time frame to increase wages to $15 to $20 per hour?
That's a hard question in the sense that what needs to be done. I think we need to be aggressively out there trying to pressure politicians to recognize these facts. And I think they actually know these things already. There was an interesting study that appeared in 2014 by Martin Gillens from Princeton and Benjamin Page from Northwestern. And part of the problem we're dealing with is we're choosing among pre-approved money-vetted candidates for federal offices. Conclusion of the Gillens-Page study said, when a majority of citizens disagrees with economic elites or with organized interests, they generally lose. Moreover, because of the strong status quo bias built into the U.S. political system, even when fairly large majorities of Americans favor policy change, they generally do not get it. I mean, just as an example, guns. Most Americans, I think, are opposing these automatic weapons. Healthcare. 70% of the American population supports a single-payer Medicare for all-type system. Income tax, proportional rates are something that people are supportive of. We don't have any of these things. Gillens and Page go on to say, Our analysis suggests that the majority of American public actually have little influence over the policies of our government adopts. Americans do enjoy many features central to democratic governors, such as regular elections, freedom of speech and association, and a widespread, if still contested, franchise. But we believe that if policymaking is dominated by powerful business organizations and a small number of affluent Americans, then America's claims to be in a democratic society are seriously threatened. So, I mean, I think that that's calling for an overhaul of the political system where we have public financing of campaigns and limits have to be imposed and many other changes. But these are, you know, public financing, you have to get money out of politics to allow the voice of the American public to be heard. If you're listening as a politician just to the money interest, you're not going to represent your population.
Ron, just quickly to finish up on this labor aspect before we move into political issues, and I just have a couple things there, is that just quickly, let's revisit income inequality and low wages. What kind of short-term and long-term impact are these two issues having on all workers and their families? And I'll just list what I have here, and I'm sure you're going to, you know, agree. Housing expense, food prices, medical care, transportation and energy costs, education for children, and just so many others. And I'm just at this point thinking that for this important segment of our U.S. society, that quote-unquote disposable income is a thing of the past.
Well, again, there are many things that could be done in a if we had a fair and just political system. But what is feasible is another issue given the makeup of the system. For like housing, affordable housing, things could be done where we have more mobile home parks, because mobile homes are a very affordable home option. We could do more prefab. When you do these things, though, you have to be careful that you're not creating things that are a toxic environment indoors for the population. In Boulder County, for example, affordable housing is a major problem. Part of that, what drives that, is land. And how do you get land for more mobile home parks or where prefab housing is something that's okay? And if you are having people who are seeking affordable housing, transportation is a major issue for them too. So you have to, I mean, you would like to have the housing to be located along the public transportation lines, or you'd have to change the routes to incorporate them so that they wouldn't have to be dependent upon a car. So these are some of the types of things. And federal government could do something about that if we had the money available. So we need to cut the military budget by hundreds of billions of dollars. And we can do that if we become just another member of the community of nations, as opposed to protecting our financial business, banking business, financial and corporate empire.
I agree. And just hopefully it'll happen soon. Ron, we have about 4 minutes left. And you, as always, you're doing just great work. Actually, I might have 5 minutes, but political issues. And maybe quickly on this one, too. Election Tuesday, November 6, 2018. Do you have any progressive expectations based on the results of this election? And if so, I'm going out on a limb and guessing, do you believe the Colorado State Legislature is the most likely place?
Well, I think the Colorado State Legislature is a place where you would expect it to be possible, given that you have a change with you have a Democratic governor and a Democratic legislature. So it's certainly the potential is there. Now, whether it will occur or not depends partly on the people as well as partly on the amount of money that are used to influence the public or the politicians. In terms of the national, the Democrats have control of the House, which is a big deal because that can deter Trump from doing a lot of the things that he wants to do. But you look at there is a fight within the Democratic Party between the Clinton wing, the conservative wing in a sense, and the more progressives. And the Progressive Caucus has increased by maybe 20 people or so. But the Clinton wing has the advantage, like you have Representative Richard Neal, who is a Democrat in Massachusetts. He's the incoming chair of the House Ways and Means Committee. He will have control over most of the tax bills that come to the floor. And he has said that Medicare for all is not realistic. So, and I could go through a number of other examples. He's also proposed backing the rule that would require a three-fifths supermajority to raise individual income taxes on the lowest earning 80% of the taxpayers. That sounds good, but this is a measure that progressives have condemned as an absurd restriction that would make it impossible to fund single payer, would make it impossible to fund the Green New Deal and other agenda items. So as long as you have conservative Democrats in charge of these important committees, it's unlikely that you're going to see a lot of progressive bills coming out of the national legislature.
All right, then, Ron, we're about close to the end, and I was going to ask you about influence of money on politics, and earlier you explained that in a great deal, and I know you're agreeable with this, and I'm assuming the listening audience is that, you know, a strong free trade union movement throughout the world does lead to real freedom for all workers and their families and elected officials who lead their respective governments. So with that said, do you have any final thoughts or comments for this KGNU listening audience, especially our new and younger listening members in the context of tonight's subject, social, labor, political issues, a progressive perspective?
There was recently a panel of labor officials talking about change and things. And, for example, Mark Diamonstein, president of the American Postal Workers Union, said, "Unions and the working class need to be as political as hell. Last time I checked, the Koch brothers are political as hell. Wall Street is political as hell." A number of the strong labor leaders, including Roseanne DeMauro, former executive director of the National Nurses United, made very strong and encouraging statements recognizing the need that Democratic politicians need to have pressure applied to them, and we cannot accept the politics of the past, but we have to really buy into the new politics and the politics of the Green New Deal and other programs such as that. So I think that this is an exciting time with the labor leaders beginning to recognize that they cannot just go along to get along.
All right, then. Ron, again, thank you for being on Labor Exchange at KGNU. Always a great job. And for those of you who joined us late, this was the Labor Exchange, and I'm Dennis Kreese, a member of the Boulder Area Labor Council, AFL-CIO. And the subject of tonight's program was Social, Labor, and Political Issues, a Progressive Perspective. And with us was a special guest, Ron Forthover, retired professor of statistics and community activist. If you have any comments about this show or any other show, please call 303-447-9911 here at KGNU. And next week, Monday, December 17, 2018, please listen to La Lucha Sigue at 6 p.m. This has been Labor Exchange, and I'm Dennis Kreese for KGNU Community Radio.